We anticipated that erosion was going to be at a certain point in 2040, but we're already, as of about a year and a half ago, at that point.
The cost of coastal erosion for the military's radar sites. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 4th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Florida woman travels to Unalaska to learn about her grandfather's time there during World War II.
A lot of people will know about battles. They knew a lot about guns, strategy maybe. I'm more interested on the effect that the war had on people.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
A flood watch is in effect for parts of interior Alaska. According to the National Weather Service, heavy rains over the past few days have caused water levels to rise around Denali National Park, Healy, Carlo Creek, and Kantishna. More rain is in the forecast today for those areas. The flood watch remains through tomorrow afternoon. The National Weather Service says travel on or near affected rivers and streams will be dangerous and urges caution to those traveling in the area. A single vehicle accident this morning in Petersburg has left two dead and two injured. The community's 4th of July parade and carnival has been canceled in response. Dead are 18-year-old Molly Parks and 19-year-old Marie Giesbrecht. Two others in the vehicle were transported to the local hospital for non-life-threatening injuries and were reported in good condition as of noon. Their names have not been released. The car turned over into a ditch near the South Harbor parking lot at about 7:30 a.m. Police secured the area and nearby vehicles with yellow ribbon. Officials have not released other details of the accident. Molly Parks graduated from Petersburg High School this year, and Marie Giesbrecht graduated from the school last year. A candlelight vigil will be held tonight at 10 on the main downtown street. There will be a procession to the ball fields where paper lanterns will be released prior to the regularly scheduled fireworks display at 11 p.m. The Anchorage Police Department says the bodies of a man and a woman were discovered on a bike path in the city's downtown yesterday morning. Officers found the bodies to the west of the intersection of Post Road and Viking Drive. Police say no arrests have been made in connection with the case. Officers are working to determine the cause of death. A group of strategic Air Force radar facilities along the North Slope are at an accelerated risk of degradation. Erosion driven by climate change is happening decades sooner than the military predicted. And as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the plan now is to spend tens of millions of dollars to fortify in place.
The 15 sites within the long-range radar program are designed to spot foreign aircraft heading into U.S. airspace or civilian planes that have gone off course. It's an expensive state of preparedness to maintain, with billions of taxpayer dollars sunk into the equipment and infrastructure.
That $7.1 billion is the overall portfolio. So those are just government-owned assets.
Colonel Frank Flores is in charge of the Alaska Radar Program, as well as several other radar sites in the Pacific that all feed signals back to Joint Base Zehlendorf-Richardson. The $7.1 billion figure doesn't include the contract with a private company to staff and take care of the facilities, worth $345 million over the next 10 years.
That's primarily the cost to operate the sites. What it doesn't include are the additional costs to maintain, to support infrastructure, additional projects that might come up because of the wear and tear, the Arctic environment.
Those costs are rising for sites in the North Slope because coastal erosion is encroaching on the airstrips, roads, and residential structures that support the actual radar equipment.
For example, at the Aliktuk long-range radar site, we anticipated that erosion was going to be at a certain point in 2040, but we're already, as of about a year and a half ago, at that point today. So it's happening at a quicker rate than we anticipated.
At Aliktuk, midway between Prudhoe Bay and Nooksit, Flores says erosion mitigation has to happen within 3 years. Elsewhere along the Arctic coast, spending to fortify the radar site north of Point Hope is already underway.
At the Cape Lisburn long-range radar site, we've seen a significant amount of erosion because the sea ice isn't coming in as soon as it used to, and it's not staying as long as it used to. So we have a runway that's about 25 meters away from the coast. It's the only place we can put a runway out of the site, and we're having to execute a $47 million project to protect that runway and keep that long-range radar site viable.
Construction projects are extremely expensive at the remote Arctic locations, and Flores says the infrastructure improvements today are an investment that could save billions in the future to protect the radar sites. Though there's no immediate threat to sites near Koktovik and Barrow, the land is eroding there as well. Less than a decade ago, the Pentagon closed 3 early warning radar sites on the North Slope due, in part, to erosion problems. Though Flores says the facilities further below Alaska's Arctic don't have any imminent threats, it remains to be seen whether they'll soon be dealing with the same hazards to basic infrastructure faced by many of the nearby communities caused by diminishing permafrost and less predictable weather systems. And it's not just the Alaska sites seeing new problems related to climate. 3,500 miles south of Anchorage, the Wake Island site under Flores's command is seeing irregular wave activity flood parts of the island, prompting the military to study what would happen if a major tidal event were to occur. But there are no plans to close sites down. Flores says they are a vital asset the Defense Department plans on maintaining in perpetuity.
The long-range radar sites in Alaska allow us to maintain national sovereignty for the air. The aircraft that come into and out of our national airspace are aircraft that we have allowed into our national airspace. They're either commercial aircraft or military aircraft on a mission.
But with environmental changes rapidly outpacing predictions, it's unclear how and if spending and strategic planning will be able to keep up. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaskans took first place in all 3 divisions of the annual 4th of July mountain race in Seward. In the men's division of the Mount Marathon, Alaska Dispatch reports Fairbanks skier David Norris not only won the race, he set a new record, 41 minutes, 26 seconds. Norris was a rookie. In the women's division, Christy Marvin of Anchorage took first place with a time of 51 minutes, 2 seconds. In the junior division earlier in the day, Anchorage's Luke Jaeger won again with a time of 27 minutes, 29 seconds. Jaeger also took first last year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, middle school students try bridge building with balsa wood.
We're teaching them to be thinkers. We're teaching them not just to learn out of a book. They have to problem solve, and we need more of that in education today.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
For Karen Abel, what started as learning more about her grandfather has grown into sharing the story of World War II's Aleutian Island campaign. And it's brought her more than 6,000 miles from her home in Florida to see firsthand where he served 74 years ago. KUCB's Zoe Sobel has the story.
Growing up in Winnipeg, Karen Abel never heard about her grandfather's service in the Royal Canadian Air Force. For a year, from June of 1942 to June of 1943, Robert Lynch was stationed in the Aleutians as a member of the 111F Squadron. After the war, his medals were in their living room and his uniform hung in the closet, but it's just something the family never talked about. When he died in 1996, she discovered his flight logs and photographs, and she became inspired to create a blog.
Once I started to tell his story to other people and talk about the war in Alaska, most people had never heard about what happened here. And that broke my heart, that so many people were up here fighting and so many lives were affected and nobody knew their story.
The blog grew and she began sharing the stories of other veterans of the Aleutian campaign. As a single mom with her own business, Karen is not able to write every day, but the project has blossomed into a part-time job.
Any spare chance I get, I will probably be writing. I have said that if I could get paid for this, I would do this full-time. That's how much I love it.
For her second trip to Alaska, Karen chose a two-week World War II historical tour through Valor Tours. It brought her from Adak to Attu and back to Unalaska with stops in Kiska, Umnak, and Chernovsky.
It's like a living museum to go there and see how things were and to see the guns, and you get to touch them and feel them and see where they were placed in action. It's not in a museum, not behind glass, not polished. It is exactly as it was.
She was the first family member of a veteran to go on the trip.
A lot of people will know about battles. They knew a lot about guns, strategy maybe. I'm more interested on the effect that the war had on people, how people lived, who was fighting, who were the ones going in this brutally harsh, desolate island and living and fighting.
And the trip inspires her to keep writing.
You know, you think that this big journey might be the ending. You know, oh, I reached my goal. It's the ending. I made it to the Aleutian Islands. But for me, it doesn't feel like the ending. It actually feels like a beginning.
Karen thinks her grandfather would be proud of her work.
And he deserves to feel like that. He deserves it. And they all deserve it. So that's why I write. They all deserve to feel proud. And they deserve to be heard.
Her next big project is working alongside the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. to develop an exhibit that shares the history of the Aleutian campaign. And the museum already has a plane on display that her grandfather flew. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
A deckhand on a tug was killed last Wednesday in Bristol Bay while helping to repair a mooring line. 20-year-old Spencer Vaughn Brewer from Shoreline, Washington, was crushed between two barges after he was knocked in the water. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Brewer was employed by Naknek Barge Lines, a subcontractor for Linden's Alaska Marine Lines. On Wednesday, he and another crewman climbed onto a buoy near three large barges in the mouth of the Naknek River. A mooring line was fouled underneath the buoy, which the two men were hoping to fix or unshackle. The ebb tide was pushing one of the barges into the buoy, and Brewer was knocked into the water. He was swept underneath the barge and resurfaced between two of the vessels. Before he could climb aboard or dive underneath, he was crushed between the two barges. Witnesses told police his PFD prevented him from getting underwater fast enough to get out of harm's way. David Rosenvig is a spokesperson for Linden.
It's a very terrible tragedy. We're all really saddened by the loss of a crewman. An investigation's underway. And at this time, our thoughts are just with his family.
Other crew recovered Brewer's body downstream and attempted CPR. Emergency responders tried also at the nearby dock, but the young man was pronounced dead. While he's relatively unknown in Bristol Bay, news of the tragic accident sent shockwaves through the community of Shoreline in Washington Thursday. Lisa Gromlich is a close family friend.
Spencer loved the sea. Spencer was a Sea Scout from the time he was quite young. He and his buddies every summer would use reclaimed materials, like really wacky reclaimed materials, to build boats that they would then take around Lake Washington. And so any way Spencer could get on water was always the best thing he could find, you know, to do.
Last year, there were no commercial fishing deaths in Alaska. While Brewer was not a fisherman, the barging operations he was a part of support the world's largest sockeye salmon fishery. That's something Gromlich says the family and friends have been able to take some comfort in.
We're very aware that Spencer was part of a community of hardworking, adventuresome people that do the work that needs to get done on the docks and in the fishing industry, and that it connects us in Seattle to people in Alaska. And so we are mourning the loss of Spencer, but we also know that it is something that has happened to many, many families in Alaska. And we offer our support to all those families and certainly feel their support of us.
Spencer Brewer's body was sent to Anchorage for an autopsy. The Coast Guard and OSHA told Bristol Bay Borough Police that they will be conducting separate investigations of the accident. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The federal government wants to know how tribes use federal resources to improve housing. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development plans to create a special committee to gather that information. Lourdes Castro Ramirez is head of HUD's Office of Public and Indian Housing. She says her office will bring together people running federal programs and tribal representatives around the country at least twice a year to discuss priorities for Native housing.
You know, we believe that the creation of a committee that allows for regular feedback, regular discussion, and really also an opportunity to identify best practices and models that are working across the Native American communities will help further our impact and will also help inform the future of Native American housing programs.
There will be up to 8 tribal representatives, and at least one of them will represent Alaska. Ramirez says federal funding for housing programs has become scarce, and it's especially important for her agency to have a firm understanding of how Native communities use that money. HUD has given millions of dollars in grants to Alaska Native tribes to support affordable housing and community development.
We also have the Title VI credit subsidy program and the Section 184 program, which is designed to promote homeownership opportunities.
The deadline to comment on the agency's planned Tribal Intergovernmental Advisory Committee is July 23rd. Comments can be left on the Federal Register website.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN, and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses from art to advanced engineering and with activities from Native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
A law that made taking a college aptitude test mandatory for getting a high school diploma has expired. This signaled an end to 12 years of requiring students to take some form of test in addition to passing a standard high school curriculum to get a diploma. But as Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, getting a diploma for some students isn't as simple as finishing high school.
For Alaska students attending high school between 2004 and 2014, the high school graduation qualifying exam was a requirement for getting your diploma. The 3-day test was administered to sophomores and covered math, reading, and writing skills. If you didn't pass all of the tests, you could retake any that you failed in either your junior or senior year. Otherwise, you would receive a certificate of achievement upon graduation instead of a diploma. After 10 years and questions regarding the effectiveness of the exam in preparing students for college, a new law was put in place under Governor Parnell that replaced the exam with the SAT, ACT, or Work Keys assessment to get a diploma. A student didn't even need to get a particular score in the exams, just have a test score on file. The state would cover the cost of one of those tests, which typically ran between $22 and $55. Now, students only have to complete their high school's curriculum to get a diploma. There's just one problem, as Margaret McKinnon, Director of Assessment and Accountability with the Alaska Department of Education, explains.
The law that repealed the high school graduation qualifying exam explicitly allowed students to earn a diploma retroactively if they had not passed that test. The law that put into place the college and career ready assessment requirement and then repealed it did not put that provision into place.
In other words, once the exam was no longer needed to get a diploma, students that passed their high school's curriculum but failed the qualifying exam could get their diplomas retroactively. But the graduating classes of 2015 and 2016 got left out.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it really has to do with how the laws are written.
Students who did not take an SAT, ACT, or Work Keys assessment in 2015 or 2016 received a certificate of achievement in lieu of a diploma, just like those who hadn't passed the exam. A release from the Department of Education says students who received one of those certificates can get a diploma, but they would still have to take one of those tests. This means the student would pay for one of those tests instead of the state covering the cost. The Department of Education reports 46 students from the class of 2015 received a certificate of achievement rather than a diploma. 2016 results aren't back yet, but McKinnon expects the amount to be lower.
And so this year, I expect that there'll be less because counselors and, you know, principals knew about the requirement and would probably and had a longer time to make sure that kids had an opportunity to take the assessment. So,
high school students graduating in 2017 and on will only have to worry about passing their high school's curriculum to get a diploma and won't have to take any sort of test. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
A balsa wood bridge isn't something you'd want to drive your car over, but it can be a useful way to expose kids to engineering. The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program recently hosted middle school students from the Anchorage School District at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Alaska Public Media's Ammon Swenson has more.
In a building on the edge of the UAA campus, 47 middle schoolers are putting last-minute touches on miniature bridges. The students gather in groups around blueprints of their own design. They carefully measure, cut, and glue thin pieces of balsa wood, hoping their creations will be able to stand up to the abuse of real-world testing.
Oh, yeah, we need another clamp right here.
No, we don't.
Yeah, we just showed that.
The bridge-building exercise is part of the ANSEP program's Middle School Academy. For 2 weeks, the students live on campus and get a taste of college life while being exposed to careers in science, technology, engineering, and math.
So they are getting that experience. They're able to not only envision themselves here in the future, but actually spend some time here and prepare for their university experience in the future.
That's Josephine Madison, ANSEP's middle school director. She says that other than a push in the right direction and some adult supervision, the students are left to their own devices when building their bridges.
So it empowers them quite a bit, and there is a bit of challenge in it as well, as they have time constraints and working with others and getting all the kinks worked out in time to test.
Among other things, the students took part in an earthquake engineering session and built computers that they would later use to design their bridges. The students are selected through a process designed to prepare them for applying to college. They submit grades and test scores, complete an essay, and provide teacher references. If they're chosen, they get to attend the program for free. Nancy Neal teaches at Hanshu Middle School, and this is her second year helping at the Middle School Academy. She describes the program as a pre-college boot camp.
We're teaching them to be thinkers. We're teaching them not just to learn out of a book. They have to problem solve, and we need more of that in education today.
She says that the bridge building exercise does more than just teach them about math and science.
You know, they might have the mind of an engineer, but they also need to know how to get along with people. And this whole bridge building is a challenge. So it's kind of hitting the best of both worlds.
A couple of days later, after the glue is dried and the bridges are complete, it's time to put them to the test. Each group takes turns describing their process and how much weight they predict their bridge will hold. The bridge is attached to a platform and a wooden tray is suspended from the center. Chaperones then slowly add fist-sized metal balls to the tray until the bridge slowly gives out, or like some did, explode. No one appeared to be heartbroken over their hard work being destroyed, and most seemed to enjoy watching how their classmates did. One team set a middle school academy record for how much weight their bridge held. While adults look at this program as a means to get students thinking seriously about higher learning, most of the kids, like Jordan Kell, are just looking for a good time.
It's just very interesting here and very fun if you want to make new friends.
He says the program also helps him avoid a younger sibling.
Because there's nothing better to do, because if you have a little sister at home, it gets hectic.
The next round of students who will spend time on campus and get free time away from younger brothers and sisters will be kids from school districts around the state. I'm Ammon Swenson in Anchorage.
With social media, people have the opportunity to project their best selves. We pick and choose what we share and how we share it. for Kyle Wark. That meant placing his Clinkett name in front of his English name on his Facebook profile. That small act translated into real life when people at work started calling him Glakawish. In this final piece of a five-part series, Wark talks about the meaning of using his native name online and how people are sometimes hesitant to speak it for fear of mispronouncing it.
Glakawish Kyle Wark yuchutduasak yesh na chatsati. Deshitan ayachat chukanedi yadi kagwantan dachan ayachat gautakan dach hunakawu. My name is Glakawish Kyle Wark. I'm Tlingit. I'm a raven from the Deshitan clan. I'm a child of the Chukanedi. I'm a grandchild of the Kagwantan. I'm from the village by the cliff called Drum. I'm from the Lee of the North Wind people's territory, now living in exile. Today people call that Huna, Alaska. I'm really happy to see the proliferation of native names in public life. I don't know exactly how using my native name in public has changed people's perceptions of me. I think for a lot of instances, even when I introduce myself in Tlingit at gatherings I've been at, not just work gatherings, but in my private life even, I introduce myself, very few people call me Glakawish. And it's not the hardest name that I've heard of native names to pronounce or anything like that, but it's still, I think, enough of a stumbling block that people don't want to take the chance and say it wrong or something like that. So most people still call me Kyle. But Glakawish, it's a specific incident within my clan. It's a specific individual who had a particular lived experience, and that particular lived experience was recorded as a name that was given to him. And that particular experience gets reincarnated down through the generations as that name is passed on and invested in new clan members. There's a lot more meaning to having the name Glakawish than there is meaning to having Kyle Wark. There's something that transforms about us when we get a name invested in us. So being able to put that on my Facebook page is somehow giving that part of me room to breathe and giving it acknowledgement in this digital space. I think that there's something worthwhile about being able to incorporate it into this modern space.
That was Kyle Wark, Glakawish, in the final of a five-part series on Alaska Native names produced by KTOO's Jennifer Canfield. A link to the full interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Josh Edge, Ammon Swenson, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Angela Denning in Petersburg, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Quentin Chandler and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.